When I first went to Japan, I knew nothing of the Buddhist. I was so tied up learning the language and teaching and doing theology and getting ordained over there that I had no time for it. But when I came back to the States for graduate studies, I had a terrific experience that I was really unprepared for. That made me reach back to the Buddhist that I had ignored all those years. And I don't know why I did that. I can't explain it. But I started sitting, which I knew they did. And one thing led to another. I kept at it. And then people wanted to sit with me. So gradually there was a group of us. And then in my first sabbatical from St. Peter's College, which I was teaching, I went back to Japan to try to have a deeper understanding of Buddhism. The Jesuits there introduced me to Yamada Roshi, who I had a wonderful experience with him. And then I just kept at it. And I came back to the States. I studied with Mayuzumi Roshi in Los Angeles, and then Glassman Roshi in New York. And Glassman Roshi was the one that made me a Zen teacher. I think this is a tremendous thing in Buddhism, that they could make a non-Buddhist one of their teachers. They have a saying that Buddhism must leave Buddhism itself to enter the field of blessing. The Buddhists are quite ready to drop the Buddhist aspect of their lives and wherever truth takes them. There's nothing they have to defend or hold on to. There's nothing like it that I know in the world besides that, willing to drop their own tradition wherever the truth leads them. So I became a teacher myself, which surprised me. I never thought I'd do that because I was Catholic, but then the Buddhists pushed that aside and said, of course, you can do it. And I've been doing it ever since.
And did the Catholic put it aside? I mean, how did your Jesuit superiors react to this development? Were they supportive of you? And did it fit into your Jesuit spirituality and life?
Well, there's a couple of questions there. Yeah. The first was the Jesuits, of course, were completely for this. The Holy Father has urged us to do interfaith work. And the Jesuits, of course, support this. From the very beginning, we were doing interfaith work. You know, Xavier in the 16th century who went to Japan. So it was a natural fit. It's as Catholic as apple pie.
Explain that to me. It's as Catholic as apple pie, because even, and particularly in your own country, if there are many who think that anything Buddhist or meditative or things like that is an absolute anathema to the, and a threat and assault upon the Catholic faith.
Well, it's not for everybody. It's not that everyone has to be involved in interfaith work, but the church is always reaching out to others. From the time of the apostles, they went out and sought people out and tried to explain the reality of Jesus in their lives. What is new since Vatican II is that the church is not going out to just to teach others, and certainly not to condemn them or argue with them, but to appreciate them, to appreciate how God's grace operates in people who could not possibly know Jesus, and to see the great good that they have done in the world. So it's not converting people, even. The Holy Father said, for example, we should not try to convert the Jews. So we're not trying to convert people, actually, but to understand the miracle of God's grace in the world and profit from it. The church has much to learn, of course. We're not just teaching, but learning also.
But what if somebody said back to you, but they converted you because they didn't become a Jesuit priest, but you became a Zen Buddhist teacher?
That's a good point. Well, we go the extra step. They are not going to become Catholic. The Jews are not going to become Catholic. The Muslims most likely are not. And not in any numbers are they going to be Catholic, and neither are the Japanese or the Buddhists. We're not trying to do the impossible, to twist their minds around and pull them out of their own tradition. We're taking the extra step of becoming all things to all people. What they do is their business. You know, we have our vocation to go and teach and learn. Before we teach, like learning the language, which is always a good place to start, and learning their customs, and becoming one with them.
And when you started, is it, I don't want to pry, but you know that experience that you said you had?
Yes.
Are you prepared to talk about that?
Completely unexpected. to put it into words, it was an experience of the randomness of the world. there is no order really in the world that we understand as human beings. Each moment is entirely new. As the physicists never tire of telling us, there is no real causality in the world. Each moment is a new event, a new creation, more or less. And I experienced that very deeply. Not that things are impermanent, but that the randomness of things was what struck me so deeply. And it wasn't anything I didn't know intellectually. You asked me, is the world random? I might have said yes, but this was a very different experience. And everything that I've learned since then has just been a corollary of that, really. But nothing prepared me for. I had no idea. In fact, I was driving a car when it happened. That changed my life. And that's what really an insight is. It's a powerful experience, not just an intellectual insight, but a powerful experience that is life-changing and life-giving. Sent me off in a different direction.
And that direction then was, as you said, back to the Buddhism that you'd encountered in Japan.
Right.
What was it in that that spoke to that experience of randomness?
Well, Buddhism is vast, of course. It's like we say Christianity. There are hundreds of different denominations of Christianity. And so too in Buddhism, there are hundreds of different denominations, you know, and Zen is just one of them. It is a practical way invented by the Chinese or put together by the Chinese. How do you do it? All this theory, how does you do it practically? And that's what Zen is. So Buddhism is different in each country. The Jesuits sent me to Japan and I grew where I was planted. That's the language that I had painfully learned to some extent. So my teachers were Japanese and I learned that tradition. The Chinese Zen is the same, but yet quite different. You know, it's the same words, but expressed very differently. So too in Korea, in Taiwan, in Thailand, Buddhism is quite different. If the Jesuits sent me to India, I suppose with my temperament and disposition, I'd be doing yoga, you know. So it was the accident, really, of going to Japan that made me develop a Japanese Buddhism.
And how did it speak to your experience in a way that seemed to satisfy it, in a way that, say, your training in Ignatian formation and Ignatian spirituality didn't satisfy that experience of randomness?
Well, the spiritual exercises satisfied me when I first made them, and we made them every year, you know, for several years before I encountered Buddhism. And Zen had a different human experience. It answered different questions. It asked different questions and gave different answers. It didn't contradict the exercises of the St. Ignatius, but I thought it continued the exercises. Ignatius ends the exercises in contemplation. And Zen is about contemplation, about a silent attention, appreciation of things, not just intellectually so, but humanly, emotionally, intuitively. So I thought it was a continuation of the exercises, not a replacement of them.
Can you say a wee bit more to me about that continuation, about that quality of attention maybe and contemplation that speaks to where Ignatius leads us and where our own Christianity leads us?
Well, Zen tries to move not against the intellect, but beyond it. It tries to silence the thinking mind, the inquisitive mind. It constantly asks questions, and it just says to be attentive, be awake and attentive, not to daydream, not to indulge in repetitious thoughts, but to come whole and complete into the present moment, fresh. When God defines God's self in the Book of Revelation, he says, "Behold, I make all things new." And the physicists are saying that, you know, that each moment is entirely new, and but one moment replaces the next moment. It's not caused by previous moment. And this quiet attention allows the mind to develop. It prepares the mind for a deeper insight, a deeper awareness. And it must be experienced. It's not just to be talked about. The Buddhists invite us to sit with them and grow with them. The insight comes in that area of an intuitive grasp of things, not an intellectual understanding of more truths, perhaps a deeper appreciation of one truth. And that touched me deeply. And I can't say why, it's just my nature. I other Jesuits saw it and didn't think much of it. You know, they moved on to other things. But I found a home there. And then I had a wonderful teacher in Yamada Roshi, because it's all from learning from a teacher. And he was a wonderful man. He was a layman, a father, and a grandfather. He had no vows. There were no perpetual vows in Buddhism. How could you have perpetual vows in a constantly changing world, you know? And it was his personality, too. He said, I don't want to make you a Buddhist. I want to empty you in imitation of your Lord Jesus Christ, who emptied himself. And that one experience, that teaching, opened everything to me, you know. I could accept the whole Buddhist tradition and experience without denying anything, not denying my faith or my Jesuit life. It was just a new way of looking at the world, which, by the way, corresponds to modern physics. The Dalai Lama said if modern physics and Buddhism disagreed, he would go with modern physics. The glory of Buddhism is that they hit upon this understanding of no self and no causality, and the world we see as a construction of our own minds, that they put this together without any help from modern science. They just sat down and saw through things. It's a great help to the whole world.